So I found that a lot of things that happened in Ireland connected to Einstein. So it's not a bad timeline, I guess. To talk about something about gravity. Very short distances. This is the way which I done with Warren Siegel and particularly with science research, philosophic McGill. And so this is the heftiest number. And a couple of things which I would like to highlight over here in this talk is when the government that GR is an effective description of and as you all know, we don't have to really demonstrate demand ourselves, but it's kind of like interesting that we always end up playing with the lowest order in curvature. And thus this is also an effective description and complete description, because in nature we all know that we come across singularities such as black holes and cosmological singularities. And obviously one of the hope is that somehow we will be able to cure these kind of singularities, either by taking into account of high curvature corrections. So I just mentioned here dot dot dot, and I'm hoping that I'll be able to fill up those dots for you and to tell you that maybe there is a way we can weaken gravity and perhaps very, very short distances in order to cure some of the problems which we usually face in our daily life. So that's the kind of like big aim. Although I will not be able to touch much on black hole, that's kind of like an ongoing project for us. But what I will highlight today is there any way we could address the cosmological singularity problem or not, by taking into account of those, filling up those dots on dots. So that's the kind of thing. Okay? Now, before asking the question, let's understand what actually goes on. And as many of you know, that if you believe in a very in a cosmology which is very homogeneous, very large cosmology in a sense, very large universe. On very broad basis, you can categorize in three geometries, three kind of topologies. Either the universe could be your closed universe, could be your open universe, or it could be your flat universe, and these are the various sections. And you might wonder, why do I really believe in these kind of topologies that are very, on very, very long, large distances? Mainly because what we have found is that, suppose if you're here, so I have drawn the light cone, and what we measure just by sitting here is this, as you know, this cosmic microwave background radiation. It seems to be very homogeneous and isotropic, although it has some fluctuations buried in, which is roughly 1.65, and understanding those fluctuations is a different ballgame altogether. But that gives us kind of like strong confidence that we are dealing with the universe's topology, which is fairly flat. That's what the observation suggests. But
Is it fair to say that the topology is flat, or because local geometry might be flat, but the topology might be different?
The overall topology could be different. As far as the CMB's data say, is that it at least has to be flat to a very good extent. And however, the question is, in the early universe, either of these three could have occurred. And even in future also, we don't know. The universe could close, open, or flat as well, and remain flat in future as well. So we don't know right now. It's kind of like we live in a kind of like very strange epoch, perhaps. Now, if you believe in this, and we write down very simple equations based on the Feynman-Robinson Walker metric, which you all know, what goes wrong is that is the dynamics, is the time dependence of the quantities. So here is my Hubble expansion rate, and I have my matter energy density, which also evolves. And for a simple equation of state, what happens is that irrespective of open, flat, or closed universe, you end up with something where there's a big question mark, and you don't know what exactly goes wrong there. And a very nice simple calculation suggests that all your order curvature terms goes to bigger love. R, R squared, R full, and stuff like that. So that's the answer. What becomes singular is the curvature terms become singular, the energy density becomes infinitely large. And obviously in physics, these quantities are kind of like the units that shouldn't operate in a natural theory. Now, as I pointed out, actually the reason for this singularity is that it seems that, you know, it's arising because of the dynamics. What happens if I just freeze the dynamics? What happens if I say that there's no dynamics at all on very, very large scales? And that was one of the motivation, actually, and for Einstein to introduce the cosmological to the constant term. Because at that time, he didn't have a notion, or people didn't have a notion of the dynamics on very, very large scales. So for them, the universe was kind of like Milky Way. There were planets and stars revolving around, but there are local motions, and, you know, on very, very large scales, perhaps people didn't have enough data, cosmological astrophysical data, and that led to kind of like belief that maybe the universe is static, and the way Einstein tried to cure the problem by introducing the cosmological constant. So if you think logically, then it was a very wise choice, given the observations at that time. And unfortunately, I'm sorry, this didn't really come out very nicely, really. But anyway, so that was one of the key motivations for Einstein. But Einstein later on gave it up after Hubble found this Hubble curve, actually. But nevertheless, the idea was his there, and many people try to kind of like exploit that idea that what happens that the universe is static on very, very large scales, and that's kind of like a concept that goes back to perfect cosmological principle. So one of the values is the steady state universe, which was discussed by various authors in 1940 by Bonnefield and Hoyle, and Hoyle died, I think, a couple of days ago, actually. Anyway, so the idea is that the universe on very, very large scales, not in the scales of, say, planetary motions or solar system landscape, but on very large scales, it looks exactly static in time and space. So that is kind of like pure idea of a perfect cosmological principle. In order to kind of like, keep that always intact, what you need is that you have to create matter constantly. And that matter can be created from vacuum, that's what these authors thought. And obviously there are various variants of this steady state universe proposed since then. But unfortunately we know that it's not really the right way of thinking, partly because we find the distance, objects, quasars and things like that, they have been created in the past, and that kind of like let the downfall for the steady state kind of universe. And also one of the problems is that this kind of universe and this kind of philosophy cannot explain this cosmic microwave background radiation. Although recently many people tried to kind of like, invigorate that research and direction to cure. But it turns out that at the end of the day you still need some kind of like expansion which goes away from this perfect cosmological principle. Now, interestingly, if you go back into history, what I found is that actually Milne taught a little bit on curing gravity. So the way he tried to do it was quite interesting, because he thought perhaps there could be two times. So one time which could describe the global structure of the universe, so essentially the evolution of gravity in some sense, which he was in fact first person, I would say, that thought that the Newton's constant could vary in time. And on the other hand, the other time you describe your microphysics, such as describing your atom, your nucleon, and things like that. And so in order to keep the masses within the Hubble radius, within the one Hubble patch, to be constant in time, what he found that this quantity has to be constant. And he didn't want to vary c. So what he came to the conclusion that g has to vary in time, and g has to, the Newton's constant, to be proportional to t to the power 1. And interestingly, you see that as time goes and becomes smaller and smaller, what we managed to achieve was it was kind of like weakening the strength of the Newton's constant. So perhaps, I mean, you know, at that time, way back in 35, it was perhaps the best cure for resolving the singularities in cosmological context, because he was weakening the strength of gravity, and at the end of the day, he would conclude that, you know, essentially there is no Big Bang singularity.
What do you mean by two times?
So he introduced the concept of two times, so he was thinking...
You don't mean two time-like directions, you mean...
No, not two time-like directions, but...
Two different scales,
yeah, two different time scales, if you wish to think this thing.
Can you rephrase, because any theory of this type, I can rewrite the theory of standard gravity with the scale of E.
Sure.
And so... So you are saying that in this particular model there is no Big Bang singularity. So,
okay.
So in the different in the language, and when I have a standard Einstein gravity plus extra matter field, how do I understand their singularity in that language?
That's true. But actually, this again, it's not a very correct way of imagining the physics here. Honestly, I do not know how to answer your question. But in what happens in the scalar tensor theories? What we usually know right now, you will find that n is actually the power is always less than 1. It's less than 0, so it's always negative. And I'll come back to that. But actually, this was cured by, so noted by, in different contexts, obviously by Dirac, because he was interested in explaining the largeness of this coupling constants, and from reasonable value, he was thinking that somehow the combination of the coupling constant would go in such a way in time that they appear to be large when you take various certain ratios. And what he concluded was that the Newton's constant has to go as 1 over t rather than t to the power 1 or t to the power positive power.
I suspect that he will just violate energy.
That's absolutely
right. Some absolutely matter in the standard motion of matter.
But anyway, it was kind of interesting that people had thought on this kind of problem and tried to cure it in various ways. And since the problem is good enough, so that we are also still trying, and I'm sure 100 years from now people will try this problem. So then came...
Why would you violate it?
But you can prove that there is always a singularity if you have
a
singularity relation. So now the statement...
But he didn't care about it.
No, here the statement was that if you do it this way, then the
you can weaken the Newton's constant, so you're weakening the strength of gravity in that sense. So that was his thought.
So if I go to Einstein frame, mm-hmm. a normal four-dimensional Einstein frame, I will get a matter sector, and that matter sector must violate me the energy condition in order to avoid
the field. Yeah, and that's the template confusion I'll draw observation. And then what happened was that after these developments, there was a nice paper by Jordan, and then Lars Dicke revived the theory in terms of scalar tensor theory. And there what you usually get is that this combination, as time goes by and the Newton's constant also varies, this tends to go to infinite as time goes to infinite. So in this kind of like setup, in the scalar tensor setup, if we are very familiar with right now, the Newton's constant does vary in time, and at most goes as 1 over t squared. So it's just a kind of like historical outline, but nevertheless it's kind of like interesting to see that people have thought this kind of problem, cure this problem various ways. Now, if you look at the very modern way of thinking, one way to kind of like invoke the problem in terms of quantum cosmology, people also have thought upon, and that's one of the current research right now in the context of string theory as well. And so the idea is that somehow you write out the wave function of the universe and you try to solve it in a mini-super space, partly because of the difficulties in quantizing matter as well as gravity. So, and you try to find out some kind of like solution for your wave function. Nevertheless, and one of the interesting procedures is Hunter Hawking proposal, which somehow tries to tie the two these kind of things. So the idea here in the Hawking kind of wave function and the interpretation is that somehow you apply laws of physics by their initial conditions. Now, obviously, you do not know the initial condition. There has to be some kind of like guessing going on here. But nevertheless, this guy attempts to tie these two aspects. And nevertheless, since, you know, we are trying to understand the static wave function in some sense, it does not really address the singularity problem, but it tries to kind of like avoid it or evade it in a very clever way. One of the interesting directions was actually came out to be inflation, which I mean, we all know that, you know, we require inflation to make various, you know, good things, such as making the universe flat and things like that. But it was soon noticed, one of the most interesting properties of inflation was soon noticed by actually Starobinsky back in 1986, after 1986 or 85, after he gave the idea of inflation, along with Ruud and then Paul Galinde and Alex Belenkin and other many other authors. The idea was that if you have a very large scalar field, this large scalar field could fluctuate during inflation. So it's almost like if you're drunk and you're just wondering, there's no light in nighttime, you can just do the random walk. And that's the whole idea. So here the very large scalar field can do the random walk, and the tendency is that it can go up sometimes and it can go down, the potential here. And in this process, what happens is that, as Linde kind of like picturizes, that you can keep creating new regions of space. You are kind of like coming up with new regions of space, partly because you're actually causal horizon, you know, through which you can communicate. It actually is going with exponential. It goes as e to the power ht if h is your Hubble expansion rate. But the Hubble expansion rate itself remains fairly constant during inflation. So what happens is that you crop up various patches of space. These are Hubble patches. And those Hubble patches again, you know, kind of like expand because of inflation. And so what happens is that you keep creating new patches during inflationary epoch. So when this process keeps going on and on, then what you would likely expect that in this kind of setup, at least there can't be kind of like singularity in future. But what it does not do is that it does not address the Big Bang singularity. It rather pushes it backwards in time. So in some sense, it very clearly avoids the problem. And that has led to ask various questions by many people, is inflation past eternal? So inflation could be future eternal, as I argued in my previous slide, but the question is inflation past eternal? And cosmologists usually like to use this part of the hypersurface, essentially. They don't use that. And if you're just, this is a flat, this is your embedded in high dimensions, and so this is the coordinates, and this is the metric, usually cosmologists like to use. And if you use that, this metric, you can show, actually, was shown by in a very nice paper, the Bode and Belenkin, and then very recently, Bode, Ruud, and Belenkin, that you just look into the geodesics, not geodesics, and time back geodesics, and what you find is that they just go and hit the finite Cauchy surface, and in that sense, it has a finite length. And that tells us that, no matter what happens, even if you're inflating, it is not part, inflation is not past the time. And so these are the, you know, space like hypersurfaces, and in a finite time, you hit this finite energy density hypersurface here. However, the interesting thing is that that this exponential expanding, you know, flat universe that we believe in can be embedded in a closed distributed universe as well. And I will show you the next picture. And there, this problem does not arise. It arises only in the flat distributed case. In the closed distributed case, actually, you can construct the hypersurfaces, and it's actually geodesically complete. So you can go backwards in time to minus infinite, and you can go further in future. So in that sense, actually, closed distributor behaves much nicer way as compared to your flat distributor, space. However, one of the motivations to invoke inflation was to make the universe flat. And if the universe was flat from the very, very beginning, then obviously it's a kind of like fine-tuned issue, and that people try to avoid that, and that's one of the reasons they kind of like invoke inflation. So in that sense, if you see that, you know, if the universe started in a closed form, in a closed with k equals to positive curvature, it would have been a very nice description of so you start with a closed universe, the universe has a contracting phase, and then it has a finite radius, and then it has an exponential inflating phase. That would have been wonderful. But this argument, again, does not really work for the open inflation case. Open inflation, or even the flat universe, not the flat, but open case, where, I mean, you know, you cannot argue similarly as I argue for the closed D-sitter. Because closed D-sitter is the only example where the genesis are complete. So, in some sense, flat D-sitter is boring, because, I mean, if the universe were flat from the very beginning, then we wouldn't really have invoked inflation at the very first point. So the idea, many people thought that maybe it's good to go for the closed universe and try to address the kind of like singularity issues, such as somehow the universe was contracting fast, then it reached some kind of like a minimal radius, the third of your, closed D-sitter, and then it expanded. And that was the idea, such as people invoked in almost 10 years ago, this pre-Big Bang picture, and kind of like got revived by the introduction of these paradox scenarios and things like that. So people tried to come back with similar kind of ideas time and again. So in some sense, the closed D-sitter actually, the closed geometry is very well behaved. If you really want to understand this somehow Big Bang, somehow the contraction phase and the expansion phase. On the other hand, the problem arises with the flat geometry. So the question is, in the flat geometry, how to understand this kind of like singularity problem, at least the Big Bang singularity problem? And that's the one which is least understood. Now, if one can understand this a little bit better, then addressing this open geometry wouldn't be a difficult part. Now, coming back to, So the idea here is that somehow you want to obtain, so the question is, you want to obtain this bouncing kind of cosmology, as I showed in the context of closed universe, in the flat universe. That's the aim, actually. If you can solve that, you can address that, it's the best thing to do. But it also turns out to be very difficult, because you have to evaluate certain energy conditions. So let's introduce what's the bouncing cosmologies. Now, if I just take this, again, Friedman laws from Okamotric, what happens is that, and assuming that the universe is homogeneous and isotropic, what happens is the Hubble expansion ratio, what I do here is a hedge with respect to time, it contracts, it goes to minimum, and then bounces back. So hedge goes to zero, and the acceleration has to be positive at minimum, and the scale factor has to be non-zero in order to have, in order to obtain some kind of like finite bounce, some non-singular bounce. And in order to do that, what you require is that this term has to be positive, so you require maximum pressure has to be less than rho over 1 and minus rho over 3. So that's the criteria for very simple bouncing solution in a flat universe. And as you know, as Alex pointed out, that what you do is that you end up violating one of these conditions in the matter sector. And these conditions, as you know, is a weak energy condition, it's the dominant energy condition, and this is the strong energy condition. Now, if you really want to categorize what you need in order to get a balance for the closed universe, all that you have to do is that you have to violate the strong energy condition. So you require pressure less than minus rho per. However, it turns out that since as you go down, the getting balance becomes difficult and difficult, such as for an open universe case, the energy has to be negative because of this negative sign. And in the flat geometry case, the energy density has to be zero, has to undergo some kind of like, some transition. And in both these cases, you end up violating actually all your energy conditions, the strong energy condition, the weak energy condition, and the dominant energy condition. So if you
So excuse me, Anupam, but that's assuming that even if we approach the Planck length scale, our description of having this classical geometry and symmetries is still valid.
Absolutely, Chris. So I'm assuming that this thing's smooth for just perfect Einstein. I'm just playing with the matter sector, and I'm asking the question, what did I apply in the matter sector to get a sensible dance? And what I come across is that I need to violate some of the energy conditions. But now my next aim will be to kind of modify the Einstein gravity, take into account of corrections, and play around, just leave the matter sector as it is, but play with the gravity sector to modify in a way to get a balancing solution. So before I go, let me give a very intuitive picture what I want to do. So it's kind of like let's imagine a Newtonian gravity. Now, in a Newtonian gravity, we know that you have a potential which falls as which falls as 1 over r. So what you want at the end of the day is that you want to cure that picture. If you really want to play in the gravitational sector, you want to cure this 1 over r form. Now, if you just write down the usual Newtonian gravity, there's nothing but a conservation of energy in a sphere of assuming that matter is distributed homogeneously in the sphere with certain energy density. So, and in the Newtonian cosmology again, you can write down the Hubble expansion rate as I've done here, and where the scale factor takes the role of the radius of the sphere. Now, what happens here is that this is what you get. This is what you get in your right hand side: the energy density and some term, and that term actually corresponds to your geometry, the closed geometry, because I'm taking the closed geometry here. Now, if you assume that this term is zero, that would be happening if you assume that somehow you're taking the radius to be infinitely large. What you would get actually the first term. So the idea behind this is that if you can modify the nature of the Newtonian potential in such a way that the potential itself tends to become constant on very, very small scale, then what you're doing is that very, very short distances, this term is vanishing. And that's what exactly the reasoning for the balance I gave in my last slide. So h becomes zero at very, very small distances. Somehow, questions provided if I can cure my Newtonian potential. And so in some sense, it is kind of like pointing towards my asymptotic freedom. There's a kind of very strong notion. I would use it slightly, weaker content. Sorry.
What's
MP. Oh, sorry about that. I didn't mean this M time. This is the time. No.
So it should be minus 3.2.
You're saying, sorry about this.
It's a denominator. It's sitting in an unusual place.
Yeah, it's just geniuteness.
Ah, it's not the type. Thanks. Yeah, it has to be, yes. Absolutely, one little impact. But I'm not playing here with the Planck mass. I'm just saying that it's literally constant. All that I'm saying here is that I want to cure my potential short distances such a way that I get this condition for passing. So I was telling you that I wouldn't use the asymptotic freedom partly because I do not know what exactly asymptotic freedom is in the context of gravity, which I'm not doing with quantum version of gravity, where I could address this question. What rather I would use is something called asymptotic safety, which actually was first introduced by Weinberg, way back in 1975-76. And Erich Schrödinger introduced this notion. So, as you all know, that the problems do not arise in a renormalizable theories because renormalizable theories by nature, they are safe, and there's always a subset of trajectories which are parameterized by your coupling constants, and the renormalized coupling constants, and they always as you take the cutoff, the momentum cutoff to infinite, they all have these coupling constant vanishes in the kind of like most of the time, known renormalizable theories. So what Weinberg actually does is that he tries to, addresses this problem in a way that let's introduce this kind of very simple beta function, very nice arbitrary equation for the subtangents. And so the way he argues is that, let's imagine that if my coupling g lambda were zero, were greater than zero, then what would happen is that all the trajectories would actually hit a singular point if you solve this arbitrary equation. And that's kind of like relevant for my this solution. On the other hand, if you take g lambda to be less than zero, then what happens is that the trajectories hit a fixed point when lambda goes to infinity. And as a consequence, what happens is that your Green function and everything, they're all kind of like physically well defined. They do not get any unphysical similarities and things like that. So this is what we would like to have in the context of gravity. Partly because we do not know in gravity, because it's kind of like non-renounceable theories, and we are working in a regime lower than the scale of Planckian scale. So our best hope right now with the given technology is that somehow we kind of flow towards all the trajectories flow towards some fixed point where my coupling constant vanishes, or the strength of gravity vanishes. So in some sense, I want to revive this Mills idea, but in a slightly different way. So, but the question is, so that's a big question, that can we really weaken gravity at very, very short distances? And or at high energies. So actually, people have looked into this problem, and authors, I'm just quoting one of the first Kelly Stealth's paper, where he looked into the action, something like R squared, and your curvature y squared. But what he noticed, what he found, was that this kind of theory is very hard to make simultaneously asymptotically free and also cost free. Partly because you know that whenever you have higher derivative terms or higher curvature terms, not only in gravity but also in any simple scalar field theory, for instance, you always come across holes in your theory. So depending on the coefficient, the C naught and V naught, this theory could be either cost free or it could be either asymptotically free. But and we also managed to show that for certain combinations of these coefficients, theory could be even renounceable. And later on, including Rob had also written some paper which I haven't read. but that's why I think if I understood this point, perhaps this point is that from string theory side, whatever high derivative terms you get, these theories are at least code free. And also there was a very nice paper by Barton Zerbeck, also he illustrates this problem. But,
yeah. Are there simple?
No.
But I mean, string theory relies on the no-go theorem. And yeah. If you keep finite, if you truncate the series, you have a ghost at the string scale. But that's how
you are. I think with certain combinations, you can show that it is it can have a ghost field for certain combinations. Even for R plus R squared, you can show it can be composed free, actually, for certain coefficients. But not for all coefficients, you have to be careful with that.
R squared, of course, okay, you take a certain combination, you have the body to the either.
It's only possible to have a very specific R squared that does not have time to do it.
Yeah.
But that's not what you were instinct for.
Sorry?
That's not what you were instinct for.
Okay, so here actually, Warren Siegel has some interesting thought, and he kind of like communicated to me at some point, and that's the reason we ended up writing this paper actually. And he wrote this paper in a couple of years ago, and I forgot which year, 2001 perhaps, that he tried to address the black hole singularity by introducing this kind of action and if someone is interested, I can go into the details, but I will hear what I'm trying to tell you that. Well, in principle, one can play this kind of action, but it does have to be very difficult. So you want to simplify it. But the interesting thing is that these kind of actions can give rise to some kind of like infinite series. So you're not cutting your higher terms at finite order, but you're taking into account of the entire number of different aspects. So either it could this, I mean, action could be written in terms of this under certain assumptions when you get rid of these boxes. Or if you just take the higher derivative terms, this term could be written, I mean, this action could be rewritten in terms of, you know, infinite terms into this box operators. And again, in principle, since I'm here derivative, as you know, that, you know, there in reality, you could expect higher order derivatives as well, such as, you know, here I've just taken the invariant and the R square, but you could take R4, R6, you know, all sorts of crazy terms. But it turns out, again, I'm handling things that are very difficult. So I would try, so what we did in our paper, we tried to study these two kind of actions. But the thing is that here is that we are taking each part of all orders. We're not cutting it in by finite order. As soon as you cut it in finite order, you will come across with various problems, such as you mentioned, the ghost will occur or the theory will not be asymptotically free. And I'll argue in a very interesting way that why, if you take the infinite orders, you can cure the ghost free case. I mean, why the propagator has no ghost. But it turns out that this category of theory actually is no good. Partly because, again, in this kind of category of theory, it's very hard to show that the theory is asymptotically free. If you take all orders corrections in R, what you find is that the theory can be made ghost free, but the theory cannot be asymptotically free. So this is a kind of interesting statement, and I will try to illustrate you why do you get really asymptotic freedom in only theory when you take into account of the boxes.
It's just a question. This is always just R scalar.
Yeah.
Never R tensor.
No.
So you only deform the spin zero.
That's absolutely correct. So I won't be able to.
So you're certainly not going to have a normalizable theory for derivative.
Absolutely. So, what I won't be able to do with this theory, I won't be able to show you whether the black holes, I won't be able to cure the black hole singularity. But I will be able to cure singularities such as those which appear in a cosmological sense, in a cosmological, in a usual.
Right, but you're not claiming that the perturbation theory makes any sense.
Sorry?
The perturbation theory still makes no sense.
No, that's the reason I'm taking into entire account. I'm not bringing perturbation one at this each and every step. So I'm taking into account an entire non-perturbative. Trying to capture a non-perturbative theory. But, in principle, you should take into account of all possible corrections. But it turns out it becomes very, very difficult to handle, actually. So what we will do is that we will try to show you what happens when you take into account of the boxes.
The particular expansion is just the action you wrote before.
You mean this one?
Yeah.
If you really expand it.
Yeah, yeah. And do a program exactly. Whatever young kid and
yeah.
Whatever.
Exactly. And interestingly, after this action, but one has to be a little bit careful because of the coefficients. One has to match those coefficients, right? But this action actually comes in a very symmetric, has some underlying symmetry. And maybe if someone is interested, I can explain that later on.
So what was the motivation for that action?
Sure.
The box plus?
Okay, so there could be actually a couple of motivations. One motivation is that these kind of actions give you somehow Gaussian propagators. And the Gaussian propagators are very much, it can appear in various ways in string theory. In one aspect, perhaps in string field theory, where I do not know the subject very well, but thing is that in string field theory, you do get these Gaussian propagators. And also, I will show you some of the properties of this Gaussian propagation, which is helpful in understanding the asymptotic freedom, at least, and the ghost free case.
Is there a reason why there is 1/6 there?
Oh, 1/6 is the conformal term.
So that's close.
Yes, from the jump. Okay. In the flat jump, it's the conformal term. And if this can be constructed very simply. One argument would be that the term which I've written down, okay, if you want to do some kind of, you want to introduce the scale factor in your action, now that you can do by doing the transformation by something like phi times g mu from one plane to another plane. Now phi will act like your scale factor when you go from one plane to the other plane, to form John Brown's between the Einstein. Now you notice that phi has degree 1. So what I'm trying to do is that I'm trying to construct something which has, and for instance, the box plus R has degree 5 cube. So what I'm trying to do is that I try to construct an invariant under essentially 5-4. And so 1-6 appears because of the conformal nature of the gravity. And then what I've done was that I've taken a particular gate where 5 equals to 1, and then this is what you get. It's a very simple count, and it's pretty way to see the action. Your structure is negative, and that's the kind of like, you know, that shows that in your theory you have a gauge. And so the thing is that very intuitively I have to see the problem again, is that what happens if I modify this part, this equation, in a way that it hasn't got any structure which is negative. And one way to modify is by taking into account of the Gaussian propagator, which you can get from the theory which I mentioned. So that's one of the motivations. So you don't get any extra states. You have this box one, which in the context of gravity, what you could define was that you have this, you still have a free graviton propagating.
Yeah, this was argued by Bishop Salam Astrati 100 years ago, by summing up the Lavender diagram.
I see, okay. And did they take into account of all infinite powers? Or
the issue was the gauge invariance.
The issue was gauge invariance.
It was maintaining gauge invariance.
Okay, thanks. I didn't know that. Okay, so that's the motivation to kind of like change it in a non-perturbative way so that the theory is gauge-free in this context. So, some of the interesting properties which you get in the theory, which you know, the higher derivative terms, that you can write down for the equations of motion, and this is the propagator at the end of the region 5. And if you demand that you have this kind of Gaussian propagator, then as I argued in my previous slide, that you can say that these theorems don't have any gauge. But at least you still have to show whether the theory is asymptotically free or not. So in order to check, as also these pointed out, that I'm only looking at the spin 0 part, and not the spin 2 part. And that's justifiable in the context of cosmology. Because in cosmology, you know, whenever you do these perturbations in cosmological perturbations, well, the relevant part is the scalar mode, the zeros, just the scalar mode. And that's what I'm doing here. So what I'm doing here is that I'm just looking into the, you know, I'm just perturbing the entire action by taking into account of the small perturbations, g mu, both eta mu plus h mu. And I'm just trying to look into the scalar part here. And what you find here is that when you plug in that, you know, the Gaussian propagator, ansatz there, what you find that HR, the zero mode, essentially the scalar mode of the graviton, essentially, follows this error function. And as you know, that has an interesting property that when you go into the very small momentum regime, it means on very, very large scales, it actually follows this usual Newtonian potential, gives us the Newtonian gravity, 1 over r. But on very, very small distances, the error function goes as r, and you see that this function becomes constant. And that shows that, kind of like, you know, on very, very small distances, the Gaussian propagator can give you some kind of like asymptotic safety, or asymptotic, quote unquote, asymptotic freedom in these kind of theories. So, now coming back to the bouncing cosmology. So you see that now the idea is that I'm playing with this R plus half derivative terms, and now my next step would be to somehow understand that these kind of theories can give me a sensible bouncing cosmology or not. So all that I have to do is that, I'm shortening my discussion here because again, I mean, the details can be found in our paper. All that you require is that the box terms, the box R terms, all higher level terms should scale like curvature alone. And that can happen for very simple ansatz, such as Cauch. And if you remember that Cauch was actually, if the universe were a really closed universe, then that would have been our solution for the scale factor. Contracting phase, contracting phase, then you know, minimal radius, and then the expanding accelerated phase. And with this ansatz, you can show that you can solve the exact non-perturbative action which I wrote down. Because again, there's some kind of like recursive relationship which you obtain in terms of boxi and higher order boxi terms. They follow certain kind of recursive solutions in a way that you recover only, you get only set square terms, not higher order set 4 or set 6 or set higher order terms. They don't appear at all. And then the problem, it turns out to be algebraic problem. You have to satisfy certain constraints, which I'm not going to read, but certainly I'm here, and we can discuss later on. And what you get is that some kind of like bouncing kind of cosmology. So the idea is that very close to where the bouncing is happening, and that happens very close when you take into account of all the higher order derivative terms. So very close to your Planckian scale. There's only one scale in the problem. This could be your string scale, or it could be your Planck scale, full dimension Planck scale. So near the bounds, these higher derivative terms dominate over the neutral Einstein Hilbert term. And at some point, you have to do the matching such that at the end of the day, what you see, what dominates is the Einstein Hilbert term. And so what? So this is the contribution comes from the higher derivative terms, and this is the usual term which does not take into account of higher derivative terms, and you can find some interesting solution. But the picture is, the overall picture is that what we have done here is that we have to map the solutions near the singularity, or near the bouncing phase, and away from the bouncing phase. Now you ask, what kind of signature do we have? Now, just one more slide and I'll switch off. Now, you can ask whether the bouncing cosmology which I constructed here, whether could it give you some kind of like observable signatures through which you could kind of like falsify this, or whether you can verify this kind of theories. And one very popular scheme is that cosmologists always like to ask the question whether because they are always interested in generating density perturbations, some kind of like perturbations, because of the expansion or the contraction phase of the geometry. And they immediately ask the question whether you get some kind of spectrum, which is whether it's very tilted or it's very flat spectrum. And partly they ask this question because somehow our astronomers found that in the CME sky, the spectral tilt of my CME photons is very flat. And that's the only reason they want to verify this. Now it turns out that in this kind of cosmology, whenever you have the contracting phase followed by your expanding phase, what happens, so here I'm drawing the space-time diagram. So this is the line when H decreases. At some point it goes to zero and then I think it starts increasing. So what I've drawn is H inverse rather than H actually, because I want to make this space-time diagram, and H inverse is my roughly the length scale. And any mode which leaves the contracting phase and re-enters into my Hubble radius at later on, at later epoch, in order to explain the fluctuations which we see today. Now, if you just naively take the theory, the Einstein theory and its corrections, high derivative terms, and I want to do the density perturbation calculation, then what it turns out that you do not get the flat spectrum in this context. You would never get the flat spectrum.
What do you assume about the incoming state?
Sorry?
I mean, since it doesn't that depend on what you assume about the incoming state?
Yes, so that's what
because there was, it says that there was a universe before the bouncing.
Exactly.
And presumably it depends on whether that's in a thermal state or a pure state.
That's also a concern. So essentially, if you prepare your state, it could be your, as you said, thermal state, because you could assume that there is no beginning, no end, so the universe has some kind of like, has a thermal band, so you could create the state in a thermal state. Or you could create, now here is a very good point which you raise actually. Now, there's a slight difference actually. Now what happens is that if you introduce something, if you throw some matter set. Now, just for fun, what I've done here is that I've thrown one very like scalar field, some kind of like action like field, which is which is very flat. Means its mass is very light as compared to the Hubble expansion rate during the contacting phase and also during the expanding phase. And if I look into the perturbations of that large scalar field, then I can make the fluctuations, the spectral tilt, very flat. So that it boils down to this point that if you assume some other component which is not whose initial condition is not permanent, rather it is in a kind of like some vacuum state, it is possible to get the flat spectrum. So as you can see, that has some interesting. If you just take the theory as such, without any matter sector, matter sector as such as any large scalar field, then you're in trouble that you do not match the observed requirement.
But there are there is matter, there are light fields.
That's true. So. But in principle, any theory, you would expect some light fields to be present, and they could actually cure the problem. So this is my last slide. I'm concluding with some questions. So as I argue that it is possible to obtain ghost-free and asymptotic-free gravity in the context of, again, quote-unquote, in the context of only cosmological context. So in some sense, you can resolve the Big Bang singularity, even for the flat geometry case, which turns out to be usually the most difficult case. But it raises some more questions. Now, as you know, this year perhaps there are many papers on black holes and understanding the entropy of the very small black holes. Now the question is, people always end up doing these alpha time corrections, or they take some other corrections, which actually kind of like, usually stop either at R4 or, some kind of like Boston terms. But no one has really taken into account of all these high-level terms, partly because the problem is that we do not know the coefficients arising or the corresponding quote-unquote order type number for all the high-level terms. But somehow, if one can, do this program in a very nice or in a clever way, maybe there is a way to even ask the question whether one can really resolve the black hole kind of singularities or not. And for that, one will definitely have to go for not only one will have to look for the spin 0 part, but one will also have to look at spin 2 part to resolve the singularities, the black hole kind of singularities. All right.
Is there some, if I look just at the Schwarzschild black hole and I don't go into the singularity, are there some observable or some signatures of this modification at the horizon in the standard form?
That's the hope, actually. Somehow you would like to see that they should modify the horizon in some way or other. But actually, the root force method does not work. Like the way, in the cosmological context, you can find a solution which can solve the entire solution for all of, including the higher energy terms. And if you try to modify it in the metric, as one could naturally expect, but it doesn't work in the context of backwards.
Maybe not the complete solution, but you can just locally say, I have a horizon in my geometry. So what are these five derivative corrections will do to the horizon?
Okay.
Will there be a singularity? Will the horizon go away? Will it turn into a singularity? What will happen to it?
Well, obviously, as you said, that you would like to have some kind of like singular field, or there's no horizon.
Right.
If one can show that there's no horizon, that's the best solution. But so far, we have not been able to crack that problem. We have some idea how to approach the problem, but it's not very. I don't have any concrete answer for that. One has to look for the speed to path. And again, there are new complications arising in the spin 2 part. But that's what one would. It's an open question, and if one can show that, that would be really interesting. Please.
I'm sorry. So, because this is a little bit unfamiliar language. So, the spin 2 part is just a statement that when you write down the higher derivative, there are just contractions of Riemann and
right? Is that?
Yes, one way to approach the problem is that, like here, I just looked into the spin zero part.
Just R, so we reach a scale of combination.
Yeah. Right. No, I mean, even if you have R or, you know, R alpha beta, some other terms, you can add those terms as well. Here, in the cosmological context, we added this R term alone, partly because, you know, R is always proportional to H squared. And in the cosmological context, all the other R alpha beta terms, they also scale like actually H squared. So it does not matter very much in the cosmological context. But those terms will definitely be important in the black hole case. And apparently, what we concluded so far, our conclusion is that just adding high derivative terms is not sufficient. So we also have to involve terms like terms with, you know, R alpha beta terms.
Not the issue with your effective action, not the issue with the results.
So you have five-dimensional terms which all become important at some point. The consequence of some dynamics that is being integrated out, right? And this is how this action was a thing in the first place, right? But yet you go to the regime where all five-dimensional operators are as important as R, right, in the balance.
Yes.
And how do I know that this is a sufficient description? Why should I go back to the original theory where I started
from? Okay, okay.
Now I'm supposed
to. So near the balance, what's happening is that what turns out, you can show that the higher derivative terms actually contribute much more compared to just one, just the Einstein Hilbert dimension.
More.
Yeah.
Well,
those are the terms which are important. Display it positive.
That means that they all have 1 over m in certain power.
Sure. Right?
So that's, to me, it's an indication.
But
you have to go to the full theory.
But you're in a regime when you're approaching M Planck. So your energy density is also approaching M Planck 4.
Sure. It might be just not adequate description because you're using effective.
If you are being perturbatively, then this question is very much spent. But if you're here, what I'm showing is that I'm taking into account of all the terms of your problem. So in some sense, I'm taking into account of the entire non-perturbative correction.
Is it really connected to the perturbation theory? I mean, because you cross the boundary, I mean, you have an effective theory, you're just only...
I'm still doing my effective theory, okay. I mean, okay, so what I'm doing here is that I'm still in the regime close to M Planck 4. I'm not taking energy densities or anything which is much above M Planck 4 regime.
Suppose you have some Heisenberg Lagrangian where there is electric field, magnetic field, and you go to the regime where electric field and magnetic field become on the order of the mass of the electron.
Mm-hmm.
And you can take all orders in this Lagrangian together on the
bottom,
right? Because you would need the whole electrodynamics to be able to get parameters.
No, sure, I absolutely agree with you. That's the reason I can only show this case in a very particular. I mean, in principle, I mean, your argument would also go by as well, you might take other types of corrections, R4 or R6.
Well, not correct, you should go back to the sort of fundamental theory and study the...
Well, in some sense, he has a fundamental theory. I mean, he has an infinite number of terms.
But that
way, not doing anything with it. But
in the example you gave, what's the problem?
But saying that there are examples where you know.
No, but in this case,
it's not just
the gauge invariance. I mean, look, if your use of effective field theory assumes that the right description is that there's a classical metric, even when you go kind of smooth fields and so forth, even when you go down to the Planck scale.
Yeah.
And I mean, if we compare this with the Bojovol kind of singularity removal, or you know, the Vicar and Oliver here, then that is a real quantum effect, which is analogous, say, to the confinement effect in QCD. Okay? I mean, it's a non-perturbative quantum effect which cannot be modeled by effective field theory. And at the Planck scale, can be modeled a little bit above the Planck scale by some kind of effective field theory. And you can't, I mean, assume that that is right, that it's that quantum mechanical calculation that they did is the correct quantum mechanical calculation, which, by the way, automatically resolves both the cosmology and black hole singularities. There's now work of Ashrafan-Bojpal that shows that also the black hole singularities are resolved.
Okay.
And one assume that that's correct, that they have the right quantum mechanical description, and ask how important your effects would be compared to that. And the answer is that they have to be much less important. In the same sense that calculating the QCD action to higher order in whatever it's like, but not taking into account confinement, we'll miss the essential physics, say, having to do with pions, or scattering of pions. This kind of thing.
But it's true that our approach is very phenomenological.
It's not just phenomenological.
Yeah.
It assumes that there are no important non-perturbative quantum.
No. I'm not saying that there won't be any other non-perturbative directions. I'm saying that there would be. But I do not know how to actually calculate it and show it so nicely. And if both of our company can show me so nicely, I would be very happy.
But they have.
Okay.
And,
it's the matter of calculation.
No, yes, sure, but she's also working in the music space.
We're looking at why anyway.
But
I'm not saying that this is the action, but what I'm saying is that it's a subclass of action where I'm trying to do the things, or I can do the things at least, you know, I can calculate things and give you the answer. In principle, you would expect all sorts of non-perturbative questions. You're playing with the beats. And you don't know how to handle them. But this is the best one can do. I can do it, you see, my analogies.
Well, perhaps we can play Adam again.
Okay, I'm just going to do that.
I don't know.